the world needs now is love, sweet love. Hear the chickens? That's awesome. Welcome to Rhodes Radio, everybody.
Can say everything.
There's no restrictions at all.
Whatever.
I can say anything I want.
Hallelujah.
At its best, a comic will try to express something. Feeling, an idea, philosophy, something. You know. And that's what Tom always tries to do.
Welcome to Rhodes Radio, everybody. Today's episode finds me in Las Vegas, Nevada, talking to one of my oldest best friends in comedy, Brian Regan. I started out in Florida, and Brian is from Miami, and I've just known the guy forever. And not only is he one of the single most brilliant comedians since Charlie Chaplin or Bob Newhart, he's actually a beautiful human being, and I'm thrilled that we had this little chat. Enjoy. Brian Regan is my friend. Brian Regan is my friend. Hooray! I'm so happy I want to break out into song. Brian Regan, you are a guy that has brought me so much joy and happiness as a friend, and especially watching as a comedian since I met you in 1985. And you have somehow managed to avoid a real personal tragedy in your life that has made a lot of other comedians bitter and disgruntled. And I want to ask you first, do you consider yourself lucky in that regard, or do you think you're just not trying hard enough?
We can work some tragedy out in the next 5 minutes if that's the goal. As a tragedy can happen in a heartbeat, man, or a lack of a heartbeat. Yeah, you want me to...
No, I'm kidding. You know, like, I mean, a lot of comedians... the business seems to wear them out at some point. And, I mean, you're a positive light in a...
Well, thank you, man. I love doing this. And I've always tried to not lose sight of the fact that this is just an incredible thing to be able to do. And, so even like moments where other people will go, man, that must have been hard. I still tried to enjoy them. And a story I tell one time is years ago, I was playing in some gig in the deep south somewhere. And when the run was over, I had to take a Greyhound bus from there to the next gig. And early in the morning, this club manager picked me up and was going to take me to the Greyhound station that I had figured out where the Greyhound station was. Well, the Greyhound station ended up being some old, like semi-abandoned gas station with an old rusty Greyhound sign gently swinging back and forth in the soft breeze. So he pulls up and it's like 5:30 in the morning and we see this rusty Greyhound sign. And he goes, well, it's your Greyhound station. And he goes, I gotta go, but you know, if you have any problems, give me a call. But so he drops me off and I'm literally there all by myself, and there's like a cornfield across the way, or some kind of field. And I'm thinking, no bus is going to pull up here. And it was like, it was supposed to be a 6 a.m. bus pickup. 6 a.m., this Greyhound bus turns the corner, pulls up, you know, and I was like, my gosh, it's actually here. Bus driver opens the door laughing, going, I've been driving this route for like 2 years, and you're the first person that's ever been here for a pickup, you know, just laughing. And he goes, hop on. He said,
what town was it?
I forget. It was like Knoxville. It was some town in the south, man. And he says, hop on. The bus is completely packed. So I got on. He goes, you're going to have to sit on the floor. So I got on the bus, and I had to sit on the floor of the Greyhound bus, and every seat around me was completely packed. And I remember laughing to myself, going, you know, I guess this is paying dues, man. I'm thinking, I'm jealous of people sitting on bus seats. You know, so I just remember even at that time realizing that, you know, you just got to have fun with it, man. You got to enjoy what you're doing. And so I've enjoyed it all along.
I never knew that you took Greyhounds. I used to hitchhike to gigs when I first started. I didn't have a car. I mean, you gave me loads of rides back to Orlando. Mm. But we'll talk about a lot of things. I like that you say, you know, it was paying dues, because I did stuff like that and I enjoyed it. It was like the, wow, I'm suffering as an artist. Mm. I mean, until you just, you know, are sick of taking Greyhound buses and listening to that bottle roll around underneath the seats all night. But I remember my first out-of-state gig was Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I drove there for like $150 to MC. And I'll never forget pulling into Tulsa. It was like, I'm in show business, man. You know? So
I got a Greyhound.
Tell me.
I was out on the road one time, and I was taking one of those I used to buy 30-day Greyhound passes for one price. You go anywhere. Yeah, anywhere. It was called a Greyhound Amera Pass or something. So for one price, you go anywhere they want, anywhere they go for 30 days. So I did it every time I finished a gig. I would hop on a Greyhound to get to the next town. You know? And one time, the only seat that was available was that seat all the way back in the middle, you know, like right next to the bathroom. And so I was sitting there, and there was two people next to me, and it's like literally next to the door to the bathroom. And it's like the middle of the day, and a bus driver just goes, all right, folks, guess we're going to have to pull over. And he had the little intercom thing. And as he pulls over to the side of the road out in the middle of nowhere, he goes, apparently the guy sitting directly in the back, and everybody looks around at me. I don't know what he said. He goes, apparently he thinks it's okay to smoke pot. On the bus. I have no clue what he's talking about.
You don't even smoke cigarettes.
I don't smoke pot. And he's like, so I guess we're just going to like air this bus out and let this pot smoke get out of here. So if you're wondering what's going on, you might want to ask that guy sitting right in the back.
Everybody hates you.
Yeah, everybody's looking, hey, what are you doing smoking pot? I'm like, I don't smoke pot. I don't know what he's talking about. So it wasn't all fun.
Wow. Well, when I met you in 1985, you had a car.
Mm-hmm.
And
I had several cars.
Those were days we were really exciting, and those were the first gigs I ever started doing when I started breaking out of open mic nights. And it was fantastic. I got to work with you all the time. And you started in 1981, mm-hmm. and... you know, you were a headliner then. And the thing that I always tell people, the remarkable thing about you was here we are in Florida doing these, some of them very tough one-nighters. And I remember Daytona Beach specifically, some biker bars.
Yeah.
And you never deviated from the person that you are now. You didn't have a 5-minute big, dirty, filthy hunk when you're playing in front of bikers. And that's the thing that I always give you huge credit for, and I tell people that it was remarkable. You know, you were clean then, and you didn't go for the cheap, easy way out in a place that probably called for it.
Well, I mean,
did you respect them or something?
I was afraid they'd beat me up if they heard me curse for some reason. Well, first of all, I mean, like when people do work. Blue or dirty, you know, I think that's very valid too. I like all kinds of comedy, you know what I mean? But I just like to do what I do, and regardless of the circumstances, that doesn't mean that it ain't hard, you know what I mean? That doesn't mean that there's not a piece of me that's going, man, give them.
Do you have a 5-minute big filthy hunk that the public has never seen?
You know, when you say I never deviated, that's not completely true. Because I used to have an F-word joke, like for the rough rooms that I would open with, and I would have like an F-word joke at the end that I could close with.
Oh.
And then I had a floating F-word joke that I would throw in anywhere in the middle, like if I felt like I needed to get them back, you know, so I would start. You know, in my mind, cheating, you know, it's like, hey, there's the F word, you know, and then I would try to do my stuff, and then they would gradually lose interest, and I'd throw them the floating F word joke, get them back, And then they start to lose interest again. Then I hit them with the F-word joke. Good night. And then I go get my check.
Well, I guess what I was doing was so filthy at the time. You seemed like you were really clean. I thought it was clean.
Well, you only heard three. The inside, the out. I bookended, then I had the floater in the middle.
But no, it was funny. Last night we were talking about the 80s comedy scene in Florida where you and I both started. And I was saying, yeah, and I remember starting out and people, it was so much cocaine in Florida then. If you see the documentary Cocaine Cowboys, you'll see the atmosphere. You could get shopping carts of the stuff for, you know, 5 cents. And I played baseball in high school. And I was terrified of drugs. And people would shake your hand, and there'd be a folded up dollar in it with a gram of cocaine. And I'm going, right, you know, do you remember those days, Brian? And you go, well, no, I nobody ever handed me cocaine. I didn't do the kind of act that would welcome someone giving you a gram of cocaine.
Yeah, right, you know. I mean, you know, you always were like on the edge and had interesting things to say. And I think you had the kind of act that people would go, this guy.
I'd like to do coke with this guy all night.
Yeah, I wanted to coke with this guy after the show. And I'm up there talking about, you know, those sprinkles on donuts. They're not going to go, this guy, we should party with this donut lover. Did you hear what he was saying about the directions on Pop-Tarts? We got a party with this guy. Put some coke in a, fold it up in a dollar, and let's bomb it to him.
In London, like they don't have marijuana, is hard to find in England. People have hash. I don't like hash, it gives me a headache. They should sell that shit with two aspirins taped to the side. A friend of mine shows up from America, he's got a marijuana cigarette. I'm playing at the Comedy Store in Piccadilly Circus, Times Square of London. We go off on this little side alley to smoke this joint, and we're passing around, talking, shooting shit. It's burning down to the nubs of our fingers. It's gone, it's out, we put it down, we are high. Right at that moment, man, two cops come running up. The funny cops with the silly hats, man. The bobbies. And the bobby goes, we saw you passing something about back then. May we search you for drugs? And I was just touched at how polite the dude was. Because in America, they beat your ass first, man. Questions later. And we didn't have anything because we just smoked it, you know, so I was like, hey, don't forget that inside pocket. I've never seen this. The dude wrote down his name and the address of his precinct and he gave it to me on a piece of paper and I'm like, what's this for? Swear to God, the guy goes, it's in case you'd like to press charges against us for harassment. So I did. What the fuck? Here, loving humanity, thinking of universal brotherhood, and Turk and the Punch Bowl showed up.
One time, I used to do a joke about Miller Lite, the beer, and somebody threw a beer bottle at me on stage. But I was in the middle of a Miller Lite joke, and it was a Miller Lite beer bottle. I didn't make the connection, you know? I mean, who's going to think this is a friendly thing for somebody in the audience? Right. Oh, wow, somebody's trying to help me out. I just hear, I'm like, what the hell? You know, like, I'm thinking, should I hop off stage and This guy goes, "Oh, it's a Miller Lite bottle for your joke." Thank you. Thank you. Got some jokes about machine gun bullets coming up, too. You don't need to help me.
Well, but the thing I remember, later, you've done it on specials and people have seen it, but the joke that you used to do, one of my all-time favorite jokes that just would twist my sides with laughter was the thing about dogs barking for no reason. And if people were like that, the guy going out on his porch and going, "Hey, hey, hey." And I just like, I was a young comic. I'm working with you. And just, we were always buddies. And that joke used to kill me. And I remember the biker bar in Daytona, seeing these rough guys howling at that, crystal clear, pure, beautiful joke.
Well, that's cool, man. Thank you.
Why would a dog bark at 3 o'clock in the morning in your neighborhood? What is that all about? I'm not talking about when there's two dogs doing, whatever they do. Sometimes you got two going at it, Hey! Do you remember when we were chasing that cat? Yeah. You got him mixed up with a stick. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about that. That was fun. Yeah. I'm not talking about that. That's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking about when there's one dog, doing a monologue like at 3 o'clock in the morning. What are they doing? I think they just go out on the porch at that hour and just go, "Hey, it's nice and quiet. Why don't I bark it up for no reason whatsoever?" And then right when you think they're done, what the hell's the matter with you? I'm a dog. I'm barking. How do you argue with them? Wouldn't it be weird if people were like that for no reason? Like if some guy went out on his porch at 3 in the morning, nobody knows him. He's like new to the neighborhood, just goes out there, "Hey! Hey! 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 You all right, man? Hey! 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 Well, hey, that's it for me. Thank you all very much, folks.
You always acted things out so fantastically. One of the best pieces of advice anybody ever gave me as a comedian was tell them the joke, show them the joke. Mm. And you do that. I think if you look at a lot of comedians, you can see their influence and who they're comedians, especially when comedians are young. But even when we started out watching you, you've never reminded me of anybody. So, is there just too much sugar in your diet? Why has it always been this way with you?
I don't know, man. I remember one time years ago, I think I was more low-key, and I had to do a show one time someplace in Long Island. And when we got there, how the one-nighters can be hell sometimes, and they said, "You comedians should probably know the sound system's not working." I think we should know that. So instead of canceling the show, we had to do the show without a sound system. And I just jacked up my energy and, just because I needed to muscle through. And I had a great set. And I remember thinking, maybe there's something to that. Even if there is sound, maybe I should just crank it up just a touch, and show a little interest on my part as the performer. I enjoy doing this too, audience, So I don't know. I like to act it out, perform it, man. It just makes me feel like I'm into it.
Is there an advantage you think that Florida comedians had, starting out in a lot of gigs that were really rough? Like that place didn't have a sound system. I remember playing places in Tampa that had peanut shells on the floor, and you could hear the crunching when people walked and things. What about that Florida scene back then? It's interesting because, you know, like you moved to New York. I want to talk to you about that. I think for a comedian's development, moving somewhere to like for graduate school as a comedian is really important, especially coming from Florida. I always wanted to go somewhere else. But like in Florida in the 80s, they had all these New York hack comedians that were down there and like they do jokes about the subway. And, you know, I'm on the subway and like, no, we don't have a subway in Florida. We have no idea what you're talking about. And then there was a lot of really cheeseball comedy because comedy was exploding and there were just tons of rooms everywhere. But there were a lot of fantastic comedians came out of Florida. You and you and no, like Jim Brewer and
you,
me, Carrot Top, which I, you know, is whatever makes hey, people man. Laugh, I think I'm all for.
He does a great job.
And Dan Whitney, Larry the Cable.
Yeah, from Florida.
And Ron Bennington.
Absolutely, man. I think a lot of interesting comedy came out of Florida. But I do agree that there was a lot of comedy, too, when we started that wasn't necessarily, you know, long-lasting, I guess, you know. You know, I thought Florida had like a bad rap for a long time.
Yeah.
You know,
and if you were a Florida comedian, there was like a
yeah. If all they knew about you was that you were a comedian from Florida, people go, yeah, okay. Like they've already had you figured out as being a hack, you know. But so that's why I think it is cool that, you know, a few comedians were able to come out of there and do pretty good.
Well, I think you single-handedly broke that and destroyed the stigma of Florida comedians. So.
Well,
on behalf of Florida comedians, thank you.
Thank
what
you.
Is the best yeah. advice that you've ever been given as a comedian or just as a human being?
Oh, wow. Man, great question.
Take your time.
You know, my dad said something. It had nothing to do with comedy, but my dad was like the kind of guy that would second guess his own thinking, you know, be open-minded enough to go, maybe I'm looking at this wrong, you know, and I've always, like, appreciated that. And I remember he used to make fun of this guy who lived down the road who was into fishing, you know, and he goes, this guy, all he talks about is fishing, you know, and it's like, was driving my dad crazy. And then my dad one day came home and said, you know what I realized, kids, because he wanted us to learn something, he said, I realized that if somebody else is enjoying something that I'm not, then who's the fool? And that just really touched me. You know, I was like, man, my dad, you know, I figure he's like old and done, and yet he's still learning and growing as a human being. And so ever since then, I've always tried to realize that everybody out there has their own thing going, man. And it's all, as long as people aren't hurting anybody else, it's all cool. It's all great, man. So that's something that my dad said to me that meant a lot to me.
Your parents must be great people because you turned out to be a great person. But it was funny last night. We're talking, hanging out after the show, and me and these other comedians, and we're all talking, and all of us had been from a divorced home, and we're going around the horn, and then we get to you, and you go, no, my parents are still together, happily, and it was like, wow, it was funny, because it's, you know, a table full of Americans in Las Vegas, it seems like that's the more common theme in the world, and you're from Miami. How is it possible that you were not doing speed with Mickey Rourke on the beach, and, you know, why aren't you in prison now with a neck tattoo?
You know.
You're from Miami!
I'm not as wholesome as people think I am, man. That's what's weird. You know, it's like I do my act, and, you know, I don't happen to curse on stage. So I think some people, like, extrapolate too far with that, you know? I did a club one time, and after the show, I'm sitting there with a local radio station guy, the guy who owned the local radio station. He's there with his girlfriend, and I'm sitting there, and he said, about me, as I'm sitting here, you know, Brian has never drank alcohol in his entire life, and he's never, ever uttered a curse word.
What?
It's just sitting, you know, so, you know, I felt the need to order a fucking beer. You know what I mean? I was like... Jeez, man, I'm not. You're setting me up. You're setting me up for doom. Who can? possibly. I ain't running for Pope, man. I just have a clean act. I still want to curse and have an alcoholic beverage every now and then.
Well, do you think people have made too much of that? Like, where you've been the spokesman for a clean comedy? I've never even thought about it.
Yeah,
because we're friends and stuff. What stigmas must be thrown on you just in being that guy? Because I don't know. Like myself, as my girlfriend says, a dirty mind is a joy forever. Maybe your brain just doesn't work in the perverse way.
Nah, man. People, my wife, Kathleen, and my friends say if your fans only knew how dark and twisted you can be, I certainly am capable of, having those kinds of funny thoughts. But in terms of my act, I just like doing it the way I do it. But it has nothing to do with what many people probably think. Like, it has nothing to do with me thinking clean is better than other kinds of comedy. I don't think that at all. I never did.
Right.
To me, it's just a different way of doing it. The example I use is the Ansel Adams, black and white photographer. He just happened to like to work in black and white. That doesn't mean that he doesn't realize the world also has color.
Yeah.
And that also, is okay. He just liked doing black and white. So I kind of think that way about comedy. It's like, I like working the way I work just because it's different. You know what I mean? I think the world is better with all kinds of different things. And so is comedy. Comedy's better when some people are working clean, other people are working blue, other people are working raunchy, other people are doing political stuff, other people are doing prop stuff. It's like, it's all good, man. It can all be good, I should say. Some of it isn't as good as others, but it can all be good.
Well, I've certainly heard you laughing at my dirty jokes in the back of the room, which is one of my favorite sounds, Brian Regan's laughter. I told a joke on stage last night about, the economy's so tough that you can see it in these billboards around Las Vegas. There's a buff guy naked from the torso up. It looks like a Calvin Klein underwear package. And it says, men earn $500 quickly now. And what it is a gay website, and they'll pay men $500 if you let them film you jacking off. And my punchline was, my question is, will they accept existing footage? And I heard you laughing at that last night. And then we're hanging out afterwards, and you told me, because I'm like, I think it's funny that you live in Las Vegas and, you have a family. And then you tell me, your version of that, which I think is even 1,000 times funnier. Because you have the innocence of your kids, and my family used to play the ABC game when we were driving around. It's you got me with one of my favorite childhood games, and then tell me the line.
Well, it's when you play the alphabet game. You usually play it with younger kids, and you try to find every letter in the alphabet, and you try to find them on billboards.
And you can't use license plates. It has to be a word.
Correct. It can't be on a license plate. We play it. It can't even be on another vehicle. It has to be on a word that's on a building or a billboard or whatever. But I'm sure different rules are regional. But so I'm playing with my son, and we go in order. You got to get the A first, then the B, then the C, all the way to Z. Whoever gets to Z first wins. So we're driving around Las Vegas. I'm with the family. We're playing the game. And my son is up. He just finished S. Now he's on T, and he goes, T as in topless! I'm like, hey. So I look in the rearview mirror, and you see this look on his face as he's looking at this billboard, and he's like, what does that mean, Daddy? And I'm like, go ahead, don't worry about it! Get the U! You're on a roll, there's a Burger King sign! Get the U out of the Burger King! So it is challenging living here sometimes.
So, I mean, I went for, the grossest twisted punchline, and yours is infinitely funnier because you have the innocence of a child. And you're trying to protect the innocence of a child in the joke, so it's beautiful. So, do you think that's the reason why Mormons like you so much?
No, that was, no, I'm kidding. That was just a fucked up boomerang. I'm sorry. That was a boomerang.
I'll answer.
Do you play for the Mormons a lot?
Mm-hmm.
I think you mentioned something about that.
Yeah, I have a huge following in Utah and the Mormon community, but I think it's because I work clean.
And it makes perfect sense because that's the one place I've never performed. I've never been invited there. They know full well what I do.
The billboard doesn't even have my name. They say, tonight, not Tom Rhodes.
As long as it isn't Tom Rhodes, that's fine with me.
Well, let's go in there. You know we're going to have a good time.
As long as Tom Rhodes.
Tom Rhodes isn't here.
So, you know, you're in the early days, you're developing as a comedian, and you moved to New York City.
Yeah.
Which I did when I was 20, and it was one of the worst years of my life. Mm-hmm. I was living in Washington Heights, surviving off roast pork fried rice for $1.50 a day, and I could barely get on anywhere. So how was that for you when you went to, you started landing Letterman and stuff?
Not right away, man. It was hard at first. When I moved to New York, it was, it took a while, you know, for, start getting traction, you know, it's hard to get into clubs there, at least. And from what I understand, it's still hard to get into clubs in New York, you know, but, you know, I was committed and I just kept going every night, going to the clubs and hanging out and doing what I had to do. And I used to have these little tricks. Like, they always say that if you, the more you hang out at a particular comedy club, the more you'll get a chance to get thrown on there, you know? But I thought, if they see you hanging out all night, then psychologically they're going to think, well, he ain't got nothing better going.
Right,
right. So I would never do that. I would go in and hang out for like an hour, just so they would see me. I didn't have a spot or anything like that, but just, and then I would walk up to whoever was running the spots and go, oh man, I gotta go. And I'd look at my watch. I gotta go. I gotta get on the other side of town. And then I would just walk out. I had no spot anywhere around, you know, but I was just trying to give this illusion that, you know, I got spots. I gotta go somewhere else and do spots. And it started to work. I remember one club manager going, whoa, how about if we throw you on? How about if we throw you on? Will you have time? I'm like, all right, maybe, you know. And I'm like, oh man, it's working. You know, so he threw me up for a prime spot and I did pretty good, you know. So lie and cheat and steal. That's how you get ahead in this world.
Say it again.
Lie, cheat and steal. Be a thief.
I would never want to be a movie star, man. Not that I've been asked. Remember there was a plot to kidnap Russell Crowe? It's true. It was a kidnapping plot. For the life of me, I don't know how anyone would ever come up with an idea like that. Some guy sitting at his checkbook, you know, trying to pay bills. Honey, I don't know how we're going to pay this Visa bill. Oh, yes, I do. What was a spark? I got that plan rolling. We're getting Crow. How are you going to pull that off? Be like, maybe see him at a public event. Excuse me, Mr. Crow. I was wondering if I could get an autograph. Yeah, all right. You got a pen? In my van. Kidnappers walk. Oh man, I don't know. I don't know enough things. That's why I hate going to parties, because everybody else seems to know stuff. You know how you're supposed to mingle around. You ever walk up to a group at a party and then you instantly find out they're talking about something that's way over your head? I never know what to do in that situation. I wish I knew how to say, I don't know what you're talking about. May I still stand here? to start doing that.
Well, that's funny. There's a mutual friend of ours that I remember when he was in New York, when he was a young comedian, he'd sit at the bar and just get smashed. And I remember telling him, you know, it's okay to get smashed if you want to. Just don't do it there at the club where you want these people's favors. Yeah. Go down the street. Like, just go a block over and get hammered. Just don't shit where you eat, basically.
That's not a good idea. They get smashed. We haven't even gotten a job yet. Yeah. You know what I mean? You get fired if you have a job and you get smashed. You don't go there and get smashed hoping they're going to hire you. Yeah, not a good technique. But that's one thing that's cool about the, you know, the clubs. You used to get to drink for free once you got in. You know, you pass your audition at the Improv and you drink for free, man. I felt like I was king of the castle. You know, you'd go into the Improv and I'd take a beer and they just hand you beer. I mean, you always throw a tip down, you know what I mean? But just the fact that the beer itself is free, you feel like, man, I'm already making it. I'm already making it in this field. I'm drinking for free.
These people think I'm worth a free beer.
I got to tell you, when one of my first road gigs was West Palm Beach, Comedy Corner, I think. And one of my first times headlining. And I sit down at the bar, and the bartender walks up. He goes, and he didn't know who I was. He goes, but I didn't know that. He goes, what can I get for you? I said, I'll take a Budweiser. And he goes, are you gigging? And I'm thinking he's got my name wrong. And I go, I said, it's Regan. And he goes,
no, I'm Brian Gigan.
Yeah, I said, it's Regan. And he goes, are you gigging? And I said, it's Regan. It's Regan. I don't know what the marquee says, but it's Regan. And he goes, yeah, you're gigging. And I'm like, I'm just getting out of talk, you know. And he goes, if you're gigging, you drink for free. And I said, I'm Brian Gigan.
Oh, that's hysterical. The thing I always tell comedians, that no matter how good you get as a comedian, there's always a turd sandwich waiting out there for you somewhere. And that was a great thing I always loved about the Comedy Cellar in New York. I mean, I've seen guys who I think are the best of the best fall flat on their ass there. And so, I mean, that's always held true in my little philosophy that, you know, there's a turd sandwich waiting for everybody. But I don't know. I mean, is it possible for you to eat a turd sandwich? I think you know so many ways to shift gears and entertain the shit out of people.
No. That's the thing. I can go down hard because my act is it's not as high energy as it used to be, but it's high energy and it's clearly supposed to be getting laughs. Whereas if you're just kind of a monologist and you do one-liners and you're low-key, if somebody doesn't laugh at a particular joke or even a few in a row, you know, you could just kind of pass it off like, well, this guy's just talking, and you know what I mean? But if you're up there like me, crouched over, and, hey, it feels stupid, and nobody's laughing, that is glaringly awkward. It's really, really bad. So I will either usually do, you know, good or pretty good, but on that crazy night where it ain't happening, where the planets don't line up, it's not just bad. It's horrible. It's horrible, man.
Well, please delight us with tales of some of the biggest turd sandwiches you've ever eaten.
All right. I was playing in the...
He's got it! He's got it!
Yeah, everybody
didn't even have to search!
Everybody's got those stories. You want them chronological or alphabetical? Turd sandwich number one. My first night ever on stage. No, I did a gig in the Pacific Northwest on an island for a company, and the resort was like made out of, you know, it was a big rustic looking kind of hotel resort type of thing. I was doing a corporate gig, and
I'm on stage, and I'm not doing well. I'm not getting any laughs. Well, a nearby window was open. I finished a joke, no laugh from the audience, and I literally heard a cricket outside, like right on the punchline, silenced, and and that's the proverbial thing that you don't want to hear. You know, that's the thing. Oh, I was doing so bad, I heard crickets, you know, but I always thought that was like a metaphor or, you know, like an exaggeration. And I'm on stage going, I am thinking to myself, I'm hearing crickets. I'm actually having that set that they talked about where you're doing so bad, you're hearing crickets. And the audience heard the crickets too. And I said, did you guys hear that? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, you know what that is? And I kind of went, crickets. Yeah, that's right. Those are crickets. Nobody's supposed to be hearing them when there's a comedian on stage. So they all like kind of started laughing because I think they got the vibe and they just loosened up just enough to cover the cricket noises. It was bad.
You're looking for a Chinese guy walking by with a lot of little wooden cages.
Oh, man. There's so many. You know, I mean, like, it's weird how the bad shows stay with you in your memory more than the good ones. Because the good ones.
Yeah, I guess I think that's life, too, where people just remember negative things more than they do the happy things. And that's why people have therapy. But why is that? I wish I could remember more of the... I've had way more triumphs than I have failures in comedy.
No, that's a very good point. In fact, what's weird is comedy itself, you know, one of the formulas for comedy is comedy equals tragedy plus time. So that means it doesn't have to be like tragic like a death, but, you know, you just push that to the point of anything uncomfortable, you know, that happens to you. Some time passes between it happening to you, and then you make a joke at it. So comedy equals tragedy plus time. But I always wondered, what if somebody was so mentally healthy that they could eliminate the time portion of that and just laugh while horrible things are happening to you, you know? I'm not there, but, you know, like, say you have a flat tire and it's raining outside. You're pissed off while you're changing the tire, but if you tell that story the next Thanksgiving, you're being funny about it.
Right, right.
Why not just, while you're in the rain changing the tire, just laugh? Go, I'm going to be laughing next Thanksgiving. Why not just start laughing now? I don't know how to do it, but I'd like to. And if you do that, people think you're nuts, you know? So,
yeah, look at that jackass laughing in the rain.
He's laughing in the rain.
Changing the tire.
It's raining. He's laughing. He's nuts. Why? He wouldn't be nuts. He'd be the smart guy.
I did the throwaway line in my act last night where I do this. It's pretty offensive. The joke about the Jerry Lewis, the bartender says, what's a Jerry Lewis? He's a new bartender. The drinks are named after famous comedians. He says to the waitress, what's a Jerry Lewis? And I said, oh, it's a Jack and Coke, but a retarded kid brings it out. Which, you know, understandably, that joke upsets people sometimes. And I have this throwaway line afterwards where I say, hey, people, I've tried victimless humor. It's just not funny. But, I mean, also, you're the antithesis of that. I mean, can you scour your skull and think of anybody that you've made a victim of in your humor that you went, Because, I mean, I want to be a tough guy and, you know, say brash things. But at the same time, I mean, I'm sensitive at my core and go, it twists me inside to think that, you know, anybody would be offended at something.
Yeah, I used to have a joke years ago. I mean, when I first started, I was kind of naive. You know, you don't realize that you don't realize the power of words and that, you know, everything has ramifications. You know, some people say, well, they're just words, but words have power behind them. And when you say things, they, you know, there are ripple effects. And I used to have some joke, and I don't even remember what the joke was, but I referred to epileptics in it, you know. It was just some kind of stupid punchline. I don't even remember what it was. And a guy came up to me after a show and said, hey, man, I really enjoyed your show. I said, oh, great, thanks. He goes, by the way, I'm epileptic. And I was like, okay. And I knew he was referring to the joke. He didn't say anything. You know, he didn't say like, hey, man, that was a little out of line or whatever. But I remember realizing on that night, like, wow, when you say something, there could be somebody out there that, I don't know, that might not take that in a way that you wanted it to be taken, you know? I used to have a joke about a specific person, and it's a good joke, but like I took it out of my act years ago. You remember Baby Faye? She was the baby that they put the orangutan part in.
Yeah.
Well, when I first started, I had a joke about Baby Faye.
Who wouldn't
have a Baby Faye joke? And I've since I won't do the joke because it's like now I realize I have kids. That there's somebody out there who that was their baby. Yeah, I don't know if that baby is still alive or not, but you know what I mean? But the joke the joke was I said, hey, y'all hear about Baby Faye, you know, they put an orangutan heart in her. And everybody knew about that because it was in the news. And I said, did you know she's my niece? Baby Faye is literally my niece. And then I would say, man, that's weird. Because when they told me that they were going to put the orangutan heart in her, I was like, well, I'll be a monkey's uncle.
Which I think I remember that joke. I remember that now.
I mean, it would get a good laugh. But,
yeah.
But now I'm like, well, you know, there's a Baby Faye family out there. You know what I mean? So it's like, is it worth, for me, I think, is it worth 30 seconds to have somebody go, wow, she lives down the road from us.
Well, and I mean, that's another thing. I think that your children can look on your body of work, you know, proudly at all of it. I think when I have children, I wouldn't want my kids to see some of the things that I've said. But on the other hand, people get offended at anything.
Right.
I used to do a joke years ago about when I'm, and that's, you know, I wanted to talk to you about, I guess we've already covered it, unless you could, you know, how transformative was it for you when you moved to New York and the development as a comedian? For me, my first move to New York was a failure. I was too young. I wasn't ready as a comedian. I went back to Florida, licked my wounds for a couple of years. And then when I was 21 or 22, I moved to San Francisco. And that's where I started to gel as a comedian. And that I'm reminded of a joke I used to do at that period that San Francisco was so over the top politically. And you'd go to the grocery store and there was someone always with a clipboard and a cause, you know, helping the kids in Nicaragua and the rebels or whatever. And then one day they were in front of the supermarket with sign this petition to save the whales. And I did this thing about, of course, I would save a whale. I'm not insensitive. If I saw one on the street shaking a cup at me, I'd give him a dollar. I'd spit on it. I'd create some moisture of some kind. I wouldn't just leave him there so some pervert could do something to his blowhole. And you know, the whale would have to point out on a Shamu doll where he was touched. When I said that, in a city like San Francisco, you know, a weirdo would get on it,
yeah,
you know,
right,
just to see what it felt like. And then the whale pointing out where it had been. And to me, I thought, the whole idea just tickled me silly. And then I did that on the radio in Atlanta once. And this woman called up crying. And her child had been, you know, touched or molested. And it was just like heartbreaking to hear this woman's tears that this joke had reminded her of it. But I do think that, like, I mean, you know, God, there's a lot of suffering and heartbreak in the world, right. But I think some people can get offended if you say anything and it doesn't have anything to do with.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that I think comedians should not poke at things, man. I'm just saying that because I agree completely. You know, I do a joke about, you know, sitting on the back of a motorcycle and feeling uncomfortable because I'm riding behind a guy and I'm putting my arms around him and I don't want to fall off, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. But, you know, there are people out there who know people who have died in motorcycle accidents. So I'm sure if I go into that bit, somebody's going to go, oh, man, we know somebody who died tragically in a motorcycle accident. Well, you can't just not talk about anything. You know what I mean? I mean, anything you bring up, somebody might have some negative association to that. So I think to over worry about it is also a mistake. You know, I mean, we do need to communicate. You do need to be able to talk about things. You know, I was doing a radio show one time too. And I did a joke about, remember when John McCain, this was a number of years ago, he went back to Vietnam and, one of the newscasters at the time, and I did this on the radio, one of the newscasters said, that he was over there reminiscing about his experiences. I was making fun of that word. I'm like, reminiscing, I don't think is quite the right word for what his thoughts are about his experiences in Vietnam. I'm sure he wasn't over there reminiscing, like, do you remember when you were hitting me with that bamboo pole and I was, like, begging you to stop? And you, like, wouldn't, like, you were, like, evil, and I was pleading. Oh, man, those are the days. So that was the bit, but I'm, in my mind, I'm making fun of the word. I thought the newscaster using the word reminiscing was, like, the wrong word. Well, a Vietnam vet called into the radio station, was all pissed off, saying, how can you make fun of a Vietnam vet's experience? And, you know, I remember being bothered by that because that wasn't my point.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it's hard to be perfect. It's hard to not offend.
Well, I think that's the mastery of your style of comedy. You took that horrific thing of, you know, the Hanoi Hilton and guys being tortured and made it funny. I mean, in a really funny way. Do you remember when you were beating me with a bamboo pole and I was pleading for you to stop? That's hysterical.
Well, I mean, but like I, like you were saying, and that I and what I agree with, it's going to be impossible to please everybody. You can't do it. You can't do a show in front of 100 people and have 100 people walk out going, "Wow, that was perfect." You know, I laughed at all the right things and I wasn't offended by anything. That's never going to happen, nor should that happen. You know, you want to be able to push some buttons, man. You want to be able to have people think. It's even okay to offend sometimes, especially if you have a position on something, you know. So I don't think people should just be doing milquetoast comedy out there, you know. Yeah, I think it's okay to you know, get a little edgy and bumpy now and then.
Well, and I think John McCain would think that joke is hilarious, you know. And, you know, comedy should be healing, mm-hmm. I think. Laughter. Now, with you, this is going to be a really difficult question because it's probably a small handful. But one of my uncles asked me this question, and I was tickled by it. And I'll ask you the same. What joke of yours that you've written are you the most proud of?
Well, after 9/11, I liked the Arab-American crop dusting joke that I used to do. I can't even remember it. It was, this was right after 9/11. I said, you know who I feel bad for? Arab Americans who truly want to get into crop dusting. You know.
I've never heard that.
It's got to be an uphill battle. Every single meeting, you know. I forget all the tags, but that was the gist of it. I like a joke that, you know, people go, well, yeah, it's a little thought behind it anyway. I don't have a lot of thoughts, but every once in a while I have one.
But politicians have a lot to deal with these days, man. And it's a different world. You know who I feel bad for? Arab Americans who truly want to get into crop dusting. Could be their lifelong dream. Now every time they ask for a pamphlet, all hell breaks loose. I'd like some information on crop dusting, and let me guess, you need to make a phone call. I've been through the rigmarole. I like watching the news. I love the commercials for the local news.
you'll hear things like, a news anchor you can trust. What the hell is there not to trust? What is he going to lie to you? There's a big fire downtown. Maybe. I don't know if I trust this guy. I don't know. There's something about him. I can't put my finger upon it. Something not right. Another one you'll hear. A news team that cares. They don't care on the other channel? Like you click over there, a major highway is closed down tonight, but hey, I don't drive home that way. Oh, turn it back to the team that cares. These two are surly. I've had it with their uncaring ways.
Well, like I was saying earlier about, you know, I never really could detect who your influences were because I never really saw anybody. Jonathan Winters, Robin Williams, I would never compare you to any of those guys, just only the physicality, but that doesn't even come close. So, you know, who were your early comedy influences and or was your dad really silly like that, you know, acting things out and just master of silliness?
As far as patterning myself after somebody, I think I was kind of fortunate in that when I decided I wanted to be a comedian, I was in college, and this was before, you know, the internet, and the small Midwestern college I went to didn't even have satellite or cable TV. So there was really nothing going on. Nobody had even radios in their dorm rooms, you know what I mean? So there was nothing to be influenced by. I knew I wanted to be a comedian. And so all my first thoughts just were things that I had to think of out of my own head. I mean, I would just, at night in the dorm room, just jot down silly things because I knew that's what I wanted to be. And so I think I was fortunate to not be watching a bunch of comedians and gravitating towards them. I think just by default, I ended up coming up with something that was just sort of different, you know?
I know you're from a big family. You've got 8 kids, so... and I know your brother Dennis, who's also a very funny stand-up comedian. I want to ask you this because there's another comedy family of brothers, the Shannon brothers, who I'm really good friends with. I don't know if you know T-Shawn Shannon.
Yeah.
Very funny guy. And then his brother, God bless him, rest in peace, a man I loved, Charlie Shannon, was also a stand-up comedian. And I think there's like 9 Shannon brothers. And I know their brother Pat really well. And I think all of the Shannon brothers are hysterical, as I do the Regan brothers. But I know the brother Pat, who's not a comedian, to me, he's the funniest one of all of them. So is there a hidden Regan brother that's even funnier than you guys?
I think so. First of all, I agree with you about the Shannons. I work with both T-Shawn and Charlie. And, yeah, very funny guys. Our oldest brother, Mike, who does not do stand-up. He's tried it, I think, a couple of times, just, you know, but I think just for a goof, you know, open mic night here or there. But he could be the funniest Regan brother. And I think Dennis and I and everybody in our family, you know, you can't help but look up to your older brothers. And, the way I describe my brother Mike, his kind of humor came out of attitude, you know. He's funny in what he says, too, but I say to people, I said, you could ask my brother Mike a yes or no question, and it wouldn't matter whether he said yes or no, you'd be on the floor laughing. It was just the way he is, you know. So it's, yeah, I think if people know Mike, they'd probably go, if he had chosen to go into comedy, he'd be better than Brian and Dennis put together.
Now, I want to ask you also about television, because you're the guy who I think is a huge mystery. Like, I mean, imagine you and I back in those Florida one-nighters. And I did, you know, I was starting out. I was clutching at straws, anything. You know, I mean, I had some real dirty stuff and a lot of attitude. And, you know, you're smart and silly, which is my favorite kind of comedy. And for me, it's just perplexing that you didn't have the hit sitcom for 10 years. I mean... how far did you get in sitcom development? And, you know, what's your whole feeling towards that? Because, I mean, that's why I'm saying it's, I mean, you never would have guessed looking at you and I that I would have been a guy that had a sitcom on for a year and that, you know.
Well, I mean, first of all, you did deserve a sitcom. And so, you know, we always admired and were proud of you for doing that. When I say us, I mean our Florida comedian counterparts that we all started together with, you know. As far as my own thing, I wasn't like on anybody's radar screen. I used to scratch my head wondering why, you know, I mean, other people were getting opportunities and I wasn't. But even during that time, I tried not to get into that negative thinking kind of thing, you mm-hmm. know, and, you know, I didn't want to go down that road, you know, where you go, well, how come this person gets a chance and I don't, you know, that's a dark street to be on.
Yeah.
You know, I've always been thrilled to be a comedian, and if I never get anything else, great. But at first, I didn't really get the opportunities, and then when the opportunities did start to come in, I had gotten to a point in my career where I wanted to be very judicious and careful about what I did. I wanted to be on a show that reflected how I thought as a comedian. I wasn't interested in people going, oh, here's a funny guy, and let's just slap him into a show.
Which is what happened to me.
Well, I didn't want yeah. that because it's like, well, I wanted the show to be about how I think as a comedian. And so when I first started to get opportunities, it was hard to get through that development process, you know, because they would be like, how about you? You're married and you have a dog. And I'm like, well, yeah. I want to do something. And I would pitch something that was just like out of left field as far as they were concerned.
Yeah, you know, so I would pitch things that were a little off the beaten path, you know. And be funny. Well, I don't know. I mean, it was just...
What show ideas did you have? Because my original idea, I don't know if we've ever even talked about this, but my idea was I wanted to be a public defender lawyer. The voice of the voiceless. Like, Barney Miller was always one of my favorite shows. And, like, the cast of cameo appearances and people, you know, dregs of society coming in and out. I thought there'd be that element. And then there'd also be the element of me getting to stick up for the voice of the voiceless, you know, standing up for righteousness. And NBC had bought the script that Mark Brazil wrote. And then, like, just like 3 months before we're going to shoot the pilot, they go, we had a lawyer show fail. Can you make Tom a teacher? And in retrospect, because that same year, like, 5 teacher shows came on. And, I mean, I thought the show started well, but, oh, my God, it was, you know, it was tricky. And then you see a side of people trying to take advantage of you for your money. And then when your show goes away, you know, people stop taking your calls. One of my favorite films is When We Were Kings, Muhammad Ali fighting George Foreman, The Rumble in the Jungle. And they said in that film that George Foreman got knocked down and it took him 10 years to get back up. I wouldn't say it was 10 years for me, but it was two. It was 2 years where just, you know, I was slump-shouldered. And, I mean, so maybe it's better not to go through that kind of process. But I'm dying to know, what premises did you have?
Well, you know, I mean, there were specific things, but in general, I usually wanted to have... like two universes kind of thing, you know. Before Ally McBeal ever came out, I wanted to show fantasy pops, which now is very, very commonplace, you know. But when I first started pitching those, it wasn't anywhere on TV that I had seen. You know, I wanted to take something that I say and then take it to that exaggerated fantasy but have it clearly be a pop, something that didn't really happen, and then go back to the real world. So to have a normal guy living a normal life but see these exaggerated heightened fantasy pops, you know. And and every time I would pitch that, you know, you'd get the, well, you know, once they answer with, well, you want to just get up and walk out of the room because you know they're trying to guide you right back to something that's already been done 1,000 times, you know. And I understand their perspective, I guess. You know, they're in the business of creating shows that are going to be successful, and the way they do that is by looking at shows that are already successful and say, make more of that. So it's a very bad mix, I think. You know, it's very hard to get something new and interesting on network television because creative people have one agenda and network people have another agenda, and it's hard to get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, like movies now, you know, it's like they keep remaking the same movies, and it's they've clearly run out of good ideas. But I think the way they make television programs in England is really smart. Like, they'll do 10 and just focus the best writing on that, which brings me to another question. How come you've never performed in London or gone after that English-speaking comedy world? I think you would conquer those people.
A few years ago, Eddie Brill, who, you know, he comedy producer on the Late Show, David Letterman. He gave me a phone number to a producer in England and said, you got to call this guy. You know, I'm sure he'd like to book you over in some dates in England. I was like, wow, that sounds great. So the next day I called the guy and just left a message like on his answering machine. And then right when I hung up, I realized that I'd called him at 4 o'clock in the morning. I didn't compute the time difference. You know, I didn't even think about it. And then the guy never did call back, and I figured he must have been laying in his bed and getting a call at 4 o'clock in the morning. Go, what kind of stupid American doesn't even think to compute the time difference? So that was the only, and that was it. Now I'm banned from Europe. Yeah, that was it. I blew it. I blew my opportunity.
Because you couldn't look at your watch and calculate the times.
Well, it's something that I really get a charge out of is standing on foreign stages and making people laugh. That really revs my adrenaline and makes me happy. So, okay, just because I'm a schmuck and I'm your friend and I'm vain enough to seek this approval from my old buddy, you watched my set last night. What was your favorite joke that I did?
I liked everything, Tom. They were all equally wonderful. No, I hadn't seen you do stand-up live in a while. I saw you do a brief thing a few years ago out here, but that was like where a number of different performers were on the... I thought you were great, man. I enjoyed everything. I don't want to zero in on a particular joke. I think you're banging on all cylinders.
Great. Now I feel really self-conscious. Oh, he hated it. He couldn't think of one. I'm kidding. Now, earlier this year, I went to the Ronald Reagan Library and Museum, and I wrote a little Facebook status update that I wished that I had gone to the Brian Regan Library and Museum. Now, if there were such a thing, what do you think there would be in it? I think there'd have to be a big porch on the museum with a guy standing out front going, hey, hey, hey.
Oh, man. I don't know. Where's the Ronald Reagan thing? Southern California, right?
Simi Valley.
Yeah? I don't know, but on a related thing, I went to Monticello? Yeah, and it's beautiful. And Thomas Jefferson had a swivel bookstand there. He was an inventor, right. And one of his inventions was a swivel bookstand, which holds 5 textbooks simultaneously. I do this on my act, and I go, wow, man, he must have read like this. And then I just, like, swivel this bookstand around, like he's looking at all these different books, and then he goes, okay, we're buying Louisiana. And I say, when I saw his 5-book swivel bookstand, I realized they were never going to chisel my head on Mount Rushmore. And you see that 5th man over on the right? He read over 8 books. He did, kids. He really did. Stick-to-itiveness. Never give up. Never.
Brian, you're the man. You're one of my favorite people to hang out with, and I thank you so much for being on my program. All right, buddy.
Tom, man, thank you very, very much. I've enjoyed this a lot. I've always loved what you do as a comedian. I've always been proud of you. And when you asked me last night if I wanted to do this, I was thrilled that you were kind enough to let me be on your podcast, and I jumped at the chance. So thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Do you think you'll use this in your credits when you're introduced now?
Next time I do Letterman, that'll be
as heard on the Tom Rhodes podcast.
Let's get him out here, direct from the Tom Rhodes podcast. No, man, what the hell? It was a blast. So I appreciate it very much, man.
Thanks, buddy. I love you to death.